This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I was lucky enough to interview Aretha Franklin in 1999. We're going to hear an excerpt of that interview as our way of paying tribute to her.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
Queen of Soul got her start in the Baptist Church. Her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a famous preacher. Aretha went on to receive many awards. She was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She won 18 Grammys and was nominated 44 times. She received a National Medal of the Arts in 1999 and the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. She sang at President Obama's first inauguration. We spoke after the publication of her autobiography, Aretha From These Roots. She seldom gave interviews, so we were thrilled to have her on our show.
Before you sang soul music, you sang gospel in the church. I imagine gospel was more than just music to you. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, feeling the spirit when you sang?
Certainly gospel was my background, is my background. My upbringing was in the church. We had to attend regularly, and of course the church provided a training ground for me, so to speak, as a young vocalist, and certainly gave me all of the spiritual values that I needed as a young lady.
I'd like to play a recording that was made of you at the age of 14, singing in the church in which your father was pastor, the New Bethel Church in Detroit.
Yes, New Bethel Baptist Church.
And this is a recording of Precious Lord. The version we're going to hear was made in 1956. This is the young 14-year-old Aretha Franklin.
When my Me.
That's the young Aretha Franklin. Let's talk a little bit about the influences on you during your formative years. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin. He was one of the most popular preachers of his generation. He was nationally known through his tours and through, I think, radio broadcasts as well as recordings. You say in the book that church nurses carried smelling salts to revive worshipers who were overcome to the point of fainting by the Spirit or by your father's sermons. What was it like for you to watch your father speak and people fainting in church?
Well, it was tremendous. I love going to church. I enjoyed being a part of the choir and just doing things in and around the church. But as a young girl, I certainly enjoyed watching and listening to my dad.
You toured with your father through churches through the Deep South, and I'm wondering what it was like for you during the days of segregation to tour through the Deep South. You know, how that compared to what you were used to in Detroit.
Well, it certainly was not what I was used to or accustomed to in Detroit, but on the other hand, it was not that bad. We didn't have extreme experiences of any kind, but there were times that we were asked to go to the back of the restaurant, say, or we couldn't use the bathrooms, and we got information that you could use the bathrooms there if you, and we didn't buy gas where we could not use the restrooms. So we went to golf a lot, I must tell you.
You say about your father, he was a minister, he was also a man, and that some women pursued him aggressively night and day.
They did.
So he wasn't uncomfortable with that.
I have no idea. I never discussed it with him, and he never discussed that sort of thing with his children. But as children, we could certainly see that women were kind of aggressively taking off behind him. He was single at the time, and sometimes you might see it with ladies sitting on the front row, a little high, skirts a little high, a little short, things like that, or in other ways that we're all familiar with. You know when women are interested.
I thought I'd play an excerpt from what is perhaps his most famous recorded sermon, The Eagle Stirreth. Since we'll only be hearing an excerpt just to get a sense of his style of preaching, can you tell us a little bit about what the sermon was actually about?
Having to do, as I equate it, to life, to children, to the parental function in the raising of one's children, and in certain other ways, there are parallels to your personal life.
My guest is Aretha Franklin. Let's hear an excerpt of a sermon preached by her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin.
Most of us forget it.
Yeah, right.
It is said that there was a man who had a poultry farm.
Yes.
And that he raised chickens for the market.
Yes.
And one day in one of his broods, he discovered a strange-looking bird.
Yes.
That was very much unlike the other chickens on the yard.
Yes.
And the man didn't pay too much attention, but he noticed as time went on that this strange-looking bird was unusual.
Yes.
He outgrew the other little chicken.
Yes.
Oh, Lord. And then one day a man who knew eagles, when he saw it, came along and saw that little eagle walking in the yard. And he said to his friend, "Do you know that you have an eagle here? What you ought to do is build a cage. After a while, when he's a little older, he's going to get tired of the ground. Yes, he will. He's going to rise up on the pinion of his wings."
That's Aretha Franklin's late father, Reverend C.L. Franklin. Many singers who grew up in the church weren't allowed by their parents to listen to or to perform pop music. It wasn't that way in your family. What did your father think about pop music and jazz?
My dad, I think, appreciated gifted artists. We just didn't have that problem in our home. Rockin' with Leroy used to come on when I would come in from school. It was a very, very big R&B broadcast of the day when I was a young girl. And I would come in and put my books down, lie down on the floor, and listen to Rockin' with Leroy. My dad really appreciated music. He appreciated gifted artists, as I said. And he never tried to limit us in any way with respect to music or anything like that.
Well, as you describe in your new autobiography, great performers like Nat Cole and Art Tatum knew your father and would sometimes be in your living room at the piano. That must have been something.
Yes, that's true. Art Tatum was often a visitor in our home. He was a very good friend of my dad's, Oscar Peterson, and Arthur Prysock, Mahalia Jackson, of course, James, and he loved Sam Cooke. And he just really very broadly appreciated one's artistry when they were truly gifted and really good.
Now, you were playing a lot of clubs during those early years, and a lot of those clubs were jazz clubs, and the people who you shared a bill with included John Coltrane and Charles Mingus. Was this a new kind of music for you?
Not exactly a new kind of music. As a very small girl, I listened to Charlie Parker and loved him, and Max Roach and people like that. I had not been in the jazz environment, having been brought up in the church. But once I got to New York and I was signed to perform at the Village Gate and the Vanguard and clubs like that. And these, the Vanguard was one of the most elite, if not the most elite, jazz club out there. Then I began to meet jazz musicians and to become more familiar with that environment and comfortable with it.
What was different about the jazz environment? What were some of the things you hadn't been exposed to before?
Well, I certainly had not been exposed to Charlie Mingus reaching over, and I think he slapped the pianist that one night.
Right. Sounds like Mingus.
Sitting in the audience then, this was at the Village Gate, and he kept right on playing. You know, nobody missed a beat.
In 1966, after your contract with Columbia Records was up, you moved to Atlantic Records, which was the home of rhythm and blues greats like Ruth Brown and Ray Charles. Laverne Baker, the Drifters, the Clovers. How did you end up at Atlantic?
We got a call. My former husband, Ted White, got a call from Jerry Wexler that they were interested in talking to and signing me at Atlantic Records. And we went over, we sat, and we talked to Jerry. Jerry offered a delightful little bonus, and of course the rest is history.
Your sound really changed at Atlantic, and so did your material. Did he set you down before you started recording and say, this is what I see for you, this is what I hear?
Yes, he did. Actually, where I had been in the booth most of the time at Columbia, And not at the piano, Jerry asked me to sit down and accompany myself. And that is where my career really took a drastic 160-degree turnaround. I just accompany myself in a very different way than most other pianists do. And I think that that was the factor that made the difference.
Now, your second single was Respect, which is, I believe, mm-hmm. your still most requested song. How did you end up singing this Otis Redding song?
Well, I heard Mr. Redding's version of it. I just loved it. And I decided that I wanted to record it. And my sister Carolyn and I got together. I was living in a small apartment on the west side of Detroit. Piano by the window, watching the cars go by. And we came up with that infamous line, the sock it to me line. It was a cliche of the day. Actually, we didn't just come up with it. It really was cliche. And some of the girls were saying that to the fellas, like, sock it to me in this way or sock it to me in that way. Nothing sexual, and it's not sexual. It was non-sexual, just a cliche line. But anyway, Laugh In picked it up, and it just kind of perpetuated itself and went on from there.
Well, let's hear Aretha Franklin singing Respect. This song mean to you when you sang it? I mean, really part of the backdrop of the song, it was a hit during the civil rights movement. And I think, you know, Respect had a lot of meanings in the song for your listeners. One was, you know, just the respect you wanted from a man in a relationship. But it also had, I think, a larger resonance with the civil rights movement, you know, a kind of larger social, cultural sense of respect.
Yes, in later times it was picked up as a battle cry by the civil rights movement. But when I recorded it, it was pretty much a male-female kind of thing, and more in a general sense from person to person. I'm going to give you respect, and I'd like to have that respect back, or I expect respect to be given back.
as we mentioned, the song, I think, resonated with the civil rights movement. Your family was good friends with Martin Luther King. How well did you know Dr. King?
Dr. King was a family friend and a very good friend of my dad's. And occasionally he would come to Detroit and spend time in our home or at our church, at my dad's church. I went out in the early days of the civil rights movement and did some performances for him along with Esther Morrow and Harry Belafonte and different other vocalists, Bernard Lee, who was a foot soldier, Reverend Jackson, with Dr. King in those days.
Well, I want to play another song that I think, you know, had a lot of resonance both in terms of personal relationships, but had a larger resonance too because of the refrain, freedom, freedom. And this is the song Think, which you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you were thinking about when you wrote this song.
The song Think really had to do with a personal relationship that I was involved in that really I didn't think was very good for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so Think became the result of that.
And this is your 1968 recording. Aretha Franklin, recorded in 1968. Now, is that the Sweet Inspirations behind you on that track?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Now, you know that it was the ambition of many young women to someday be a Sweet Inspiration. Of course, they knew they wouldn't be, so they just kind of did the backup vocals in their living rooms. So what's it like for you as a singer to have really good backup vocalists behind you? Is that a real boost?
It's certainly meaningful, yes. There's a lot of interplay between the lead singer and the background, and of course they are very, very supportive to the lead. And it's great. You can create with them and just come up with whatever your objectives, your musical objectives are.
What was your father, Reverend Franklin's, reaction to your being the Queen of Soul?
He loved it. He loved it. My dad was my greatest fan, I think, with along with my brother Cecil, and who was my former manager as well.
Aretha Franklin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And
it's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Aretha Franklin recorded in 1999. She died Thursday at the age of 76. Now our film critic, Justin Chang, has a review of the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians. The movie generated a lot of anticipation as the first major Hollywood studio film in years to focus on contemporary Asian and Asian American characters. adapted from Kevin Kwan's 2013 bestseller, the movie stars Constance Wu as a New Yorker who travels to Singapore to meet her boyfriend's wealthy family. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
Crazy Rich Asians is being hailed as a milestone for Asian representation in Hollywood, which means it's being saddled with more cultural and commercial expectations than any movie should have to bear. Happily, it doesn't collapse under that weight. More milestones should be this light on their feet. Drawing us into the privileged world of Singapore's billionaire Chinese families, the movie is a satire and a soap opera, a Meet the Parents comedy and a Cinderella romance, all wrapped up in the swankiest of lifestyle fantasies. Our guide to all this over-the-top luxury is an outsider named Rachel Chu, an NYU economics professor played by Constance Wu from the sitcom Fresh Off the Boat. Rachel is dating a fellow academic named Nick Young, played by a dreamy British-Malaysian newcomer named Henry Golding. Nick is serious enough about Rachel that he invites her to fly home with him to Singapore so that she can meet his family for the first time.
Singapore, for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family? My Ama? And meet up with that strange college roommate of yours?
Caitlin.
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
Aww.
The two leads slip effortlessly into the kind of on-screen chemistry you've seen in any number of glossy studio romantic comedies, and Crazy Rich Asians gives them their own unique set of emotional complications. There are a few things Nick hasn't told Rachel, and it's not until she finds herself flying first class that she begins to understand what she's getting herself into. It falls to her old college buddy, Paik Lin, hilariously played by the actress and rapper Awkwafina, to inform Rachel that Nick is basically Singaporean royalty, putting her under enormous pressure as she prepares to meet his friends and family. The large ensemble cast includes Nick's iron-willed grandmother, played by the veteran Chinese-American actress Lisa Liu, from the 1993 drama The Joy Luck Club, the last major American studio film to feature such a dizzying array of Pan-Asian acting talent. The British-Chinese actress Gemma Chan plays a glamorous style icon named Astrid Leong, one of the few in Nick's inner circle to give Rachel a warm welcome. The others, including two obnoxiously spoiled types played by Ronnie Cheng from The Daily Show and Jimmy O. Yang of the HBO series Silicon Valley, regard her as a fish out of water at best, a gold digger at worst. And Michelle Yeoh is mesmerizing as Nick's quietly formidable mother, Eleanor, who's dead set against letting her son marry someone so apparently unworthy of the Young dynasty. Although significantly watered down from Kevin Kwan's sprawling original novel, Peter Chiarelli and Adele Lim's screenplay has a rich vein of cross-cultural humor that I expect will draw rare laughs of recognition from Asians and Asian Americans in the audience. It also has an exaggerated, eager-to-please quality that doesn't always serve the comedy, as if it were a little desperate to ensure that everyone gets the joke. But Crazy Rich Asians soon finds its footing. The Chinese-American filmmaker John M. Chu, who established himself by cranking out sequels like G.I. Joe: Retaliation, directs with a sharp eye and an exuberantly personal touch. With its dazzling costumes and gaudy production design, the movie nails both the elegance and the vulgarity that can define the lifestyles of the obscenely rich. Chu smartly dramatizes the mindset of old money aristocrats like the Youngs and their unique contempt for Asian Americans like Rachel, whom they believe pursue individual happiness at the expense of family and tradition. As an American-born Chinese myself, I'd be disingenuous not to admit how personally stirred I was by Crazy Rich Asians, and not always for the reasons I expected. There's something curiously validating about a Hollywood romantic comedy that pauses for a mouthwatering tour of a Singapore open-air market, or a makeover montage set to a Cantonese rendition of Madonna's Material Girl. But what cuts the deepest here is Michelle Yeoh's performance as Nick's mother, who movingly articulates the complicated, often wrenching sense of duty and devotion that binds Asian families together across countries and generations. It's a tension that some of us have spent years grappling with, but seeing and hearing it in an American movie feels close to revelatory.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Missiles, smart weapons, were the family business for my guest Karen Piper. In 1971, when she was six, her family moved to the secretive China Lake Naval Weapons Center and Test Site in the Mojave Desert, where her parents designed missiles. Her father worked on the Sidewinder missile. It was his job to make sure it hit its targets. Her mother worked on the Tomahawk missile. Her sister worked on base inventory, counting circuit boards and bombs, and when Karen was in her teens, she worked as a secretary. But everything involving work had to be kept secret, even within the family. Karen Piper has written a new memoir called A Girl's Guide to Missiles, Growing Up in America's Secret Desert. The book also has the story of a cover-up on the test site. Her other books include The Price of Thirst, Global Water Inequality and the Coming Chaos, and Left in the Dust, How Race and Politics Created a Human and Environmental Tragedy in L.A. She's a professor of literature and geography at the University of Missouri. Karen Piper, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us more about what kinds of weapons were made and tested at China Lake when you were growing up.
All kinds of weapons, but the premier weapon that everyone is proud of on the base is the Sidewinder, because it's had the widest and most continuous use since it went into production in 1956. But we also make, you know, made chemical weapons. Don't make those anymore. Make non-lethal weapons or less lethal weapons, like, you know, tear gas. We made napalm. So the main thing, though, is missiles.
What an environment to grow up in.
Yeah.
So I guess it was, this is asking the obvious, but why was it located in a desert?
Oh, well, that's kind of a funny story, because it was initially these rocket scientists were at Caltech in Pasadena, and they would go into the back canyons and just shoot off missiles. Well, the neighbors started to get nervous about these explosions happening, and also there were a couple accidents at the lab, explosions, and so they decided, well, we better go out, and they just loaded up some missiles on the back of a truck and drove out into the desert looking for a place to blow them up. And that's how the idea got started. And then eventually they took a plane and just flew over the desert looking for big empty places until somebody said, there it is, I want it.
So it sounds like it would have been a very frightening place to grow up in as a child, because after all, missiles were being tested there, not just designed. So there's a short reading I want you to do from your book that describes what it was like how frightening it was to be on the test site.
There were so many things to be frightened of at night. Jets crashing on you, bombs accidentally landing on your house. Sometimes parachuters suddenly fell from the sky, or a man flew by in an ejection test seat. It seemed like there was a daily invasion going on. China Lake's newspaper, The Rocketeer, had a cartoon one day about a low-flying jet snagging a highway sign, followed by the pilot getting chewed out by his captain in the next cartoon window. The week after the cartoon came out, my mom said, while holding The Rocketeer, "Listen to this. Someone complained about the cartoon, saying it brought back memories of the time he saw a jet 3 feet off the ground in the rearview mirror of his truck. It was headed right for him, but suddenly veered up, barely missing him."
So what was it like for you growing up in that environment? How frightened were you?
It's complicated because I would say I wasn't really frightened. On the surface, it was like a subliminal thing. So you see explosions going off across the street. You hear these jets flying overhead. And you want to know what they are, and your parents don't really have the answers for you. And I think what you do is just repress it. Or you have a euphemism about it. Like my mom would say, "Oh, they're just exercising." You know, and I'm like, "Well, what does that mean?" But there wasn't really an explanation. Because of that repression, though, I started like having panic attacks after we moved to the base. So it manifested itself in other ways.
How often did you see something especially peculiar, like somebody parachuting from the sky or somebody flying by in an ejection seat?
Oh, that was something that was pretty rare. What was common was just the low-flying jets all the time, and the sonic booms rattling the windows drove me crazy as a kid. There'd be explosions, black smoke on the horizon quite often, too.
What was your understanding of war and how the missiles that your parents helped design could be used or were being used?
That's the huge question in the book. And for me, I think I started writing the book because I didn't really understand how war connected to my life growing up. There's these weapons of war. That's the industry of the base. But I never really heard about them being connected to actual wars, if that makes sense, except briefly about Vietnam, but I didn't understand what that was all about at the time. So when I started writing the book, I just wanted to dig into what wars were these weapons used in and what were these wars about? And I just kind of kept going and going. But I think on the base, my feeling was that people didn't really talk about that so much.
So when you and your family moved to this desert-based missile design and test site, the Vietnam War was still underway.
Yes.
And the missile your father was working on, the Sidewinder, was one of the primary weapons in Vietnam that we were using there.
Yeah.
The Sidewinder had only a 16% accuracy rate in Vietnam. That is really low when you're talking about a missile.
Yeah.
When you think of all the missiles that struck places and people that weren't really targets, it's very upsetting. And your father was involved with the targeting, so
yes, he wanted those missiles to hit their targets, and they weren't.
But you found out that there was a cover up when it came to the accuracy of the missiles.
Yeah, that was later, but that was and I feel very lucky that my dad let that secret slip with me, because he didn't tell anyone else in the family, and he only told me once when we were on a walk to Albertsons. He said, "They're faking the tests at work," and I had no clue what that meant, but he explained they're making it look like the missiles work when they don't. And I was like, "Well, how could they do that?" And he said, "Well, they can edit the tapes." And I would say, "Well, why would they do that?" And he said, "So they can sell them." And it was the contractors that wanted this, the people like Lockheed Martin, who really just wanted to sell missiles and get them out fast and in the field as soon as they could. And eventually I found out that this was like a wider corruption problem, that there was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Melvin Paisley, was taking kickbacks from contractors in order to give them weapons contracts, and he was telling people to fake the tests. And he ended up going to jail for it, but the weapons contractors were really barely punished, which I think is really sad.
So your father knew the test results were being falsified to make the missiles look better than they really were. Did he feel there was anybody he could talk to about this at work?
My dad was a very humble person and a little insecure. I think he just saw himself as a lowly engineer, and this is something the guys above him want to do, and there's nothing he can do about it. So I don't think he would be the type to confront anybody about that.
But there was another
person on base who did confront his bosses about that, and he got fired.
So the period of the falsified test results, was that a period of the Sidewinder when your father was still working on the Sidewinder?
Yes.
And was that in the Vietnam era?
No, that was in the 80s. Although I'm not sure how far back it went. But the problems with the Sidewinder in the Vietnam era were due to the fact that they couldn't function, the Sidewinders couldn't really function in hazy weather or rainy weather. And so there's a lot of haze and rain in Vietnam. And so they couldn't use it. And the North Vietnamese figured out quickly just to attack when it's like raining. Because the Sidewinder, if it was hazy, it would get attracted to the sunlight reflecting off the clouds.
Because it was heat-seeking.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't help but wonder, you know, how all this made your father feel.
I think he felt guilty, like, personally, that it was his fault when it really wasn't, if that makes sense. I don't think he felt guilty that he didn't say anything. I think he felt guilty, like, he wasn't doing a good enough job to make the Sidewinder work, and that this would kill innocent people.
So let's talk about the role of church in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents were Baptists, and all the churches were off the military site because of separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why your family moved off the base into the surrounding official town part surrounding the base, where everybody who lived there was attached to the to the base in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to a Christian school. Will you say you had to pledge allegiance to the American flag, the Christian flag, and to the Bible?
Mm-hmm, the Bible.
What were the Christian flag and Bible pledges like?
I pledge allegiance to the Bible, God's holy word. Let it... Oh, man. People who know it will get mad at me that I can't remember. Let it be a light in my heart and a something or other. And the Christian flag is pledge allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Savior for which it stands. One, that's all I can remember.
So in your science class, you learned that humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time, which they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other scientifically not true things that might sound biblically correct but scientifically untrue that you learned in science class. And I think it's just kind of fascinating that a Christian school for the children of scientists and engineers would be taught this kind of fake science.
I know.
That they'd be science deniers.
I know. It's like I don't understand it to this day. Except that maybe the Baptists offered a very kind of comforting black and white view of the world. And I sometimes wondered if with all the ambiguity surrounding war, if that made life easier. It provided justifications for war, for one thing.
Did you learn those justifications in class? Did the teachers realize your parents were designing weapons and that you needed to hear a justification?
Yeah, well, so that the communists were evil, that was in my little booklets that they were called Packets of Accelerated Christian Education that I learned from. It was very anti-communist. And then there was some racist stuff about you know, Africans being heathens, although that wasn't related to war. That was why we need to go have missionaries over there.
There was a time when the traveling record breaker came to town to preach about the evils of rock music. Did he literally break records and destroy
yes.
tapes?
Yeah, yeah. And I saw him one time on, there was a YouTube video of him, and I went, oh my God, that's the guy. But I could never find it again because it just seems so surreal. It's like, did I imagine this? But yeah, and my mom's like, oh yeah, when she read my book, she goes, I remember that crystal ball. Yeah, there was that woman with the crystal, because one woman took a crystal ball down the aisle to have it broken, and he couldn't break it. It was too solid. But yeah, he would break them, and then he would do back masking, where you play them backwards so you can hear Satan talking.
Did you have any records or tapes that he destroyed?
No, because we weren't allowed to have records like that in the house. But the reason I went forward that time was because I had, in fourth grade, I had a little boyfriend, quote unquote, which meant we like held hands walking to school. And I went to his house and he would play Beatles albums for me. And my pastor.
Forward or backwards?
Forward. I didn't know you could do backwards. But I go, you know, this church, and they're saying, oh, the Beatles are evil, you know, and they're satanic. And so I was like, oh, no. And anyway, I had to go forward and confess everything. And I just cried and cried. But yeah, he prayed with me and I was fine.
So you grew up surrounded by missiles, but you say the most frightening thing was the rapture.
Yeah.
Tell us why.
Well, because I was very devout Christian growing up, and there was this thing called the rapture that's going to take people away any day if you're not saved. And I was never quite sure if I was saved because there were all these rules about it. And like you had to reach the end of the age of innocence, which is when you don't have to be saved, but nobody told you when it was. So then it was like, okay, I am 7. Should I get saved? Is there a time between that ending and not being saved where something's going to happen? And so I was just convinced the rapture was going to happen, and I'd wake up one day and everybody would be gone, and I'd be in the time of the tribulation, which is terrible, all alone. So I had like panic attacks about other things too besides weapons.
You lived in a world of apocalypse.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like, wow.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, there's movies about the rapture and the times of tribulations.
But also you're surrounded by missiles.
We had to watch. Yeah,
and
yeah.
By unexploded ordnance. Like one of the things you had to learn is like, be careful where you walk because it's a test site. Might step on a bomb.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or a lizard or a scorpion or tarantula.
Yeah, but they were cool. They were my friends. Uh-huh. They're pretty easy to avoid.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you stopped believing in the rapture? And was it a relief to not have to worry about it anymore?
Yes. I think what happened first is I stopped believing in hell when I was 9. I got kind of bored in church, and because they always said the same things over and over again. So I would just sit there and read the Bible. And the Bible was actually kind of interesting, and it had really weird stories in it. And I just decided that, you know, you could sort of pick and choose the ones that you want to believe in. And I decided, because that's what Luther was all about. Like, you could interpret the Bible yourself for once, and the Pope can't tell you how to read it. So I decided that if God was good, he wouldn't have made a hell. That didn't make any sense. So that must have been some kind of mistake, and therefore it no longer exists. And so that was the biggest relief. I don't know, the rapture, I'm not sure when I grew out of that. I mean, the rest of it stuck with me for a while.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been great. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.